The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And. My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Kim Scott. Kim is the co-founder of Candor, Inc. and the author of the book Radical Candor, which will be published in March of 2017. Kim has been an advisor to several Silicon Valley companies and was a faculty member at Apple University. She has had a fascinating career that includes being a senior policy advisor at the FCC and starting a diamond cutting factory in Moscow. Kim Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So in the last few weeks, we've talked to Simon Sinek, Gretchen Rubin, Bob Sutton, Dan Pink, and I think the thing that connects all of them and your work is that this idea that we human beings have made some terrible assumptions about our ability to effectively work with other human beings. And each of you are basically offering up hacks, almost verbal, behavioral, systematic hacks that individuals can apply to make work and life better, which is frankly what we've done at Second City since 1959.
Yes, I admire the work that you all do at Second City. And in fact, Dan Pink named Radical Candor Radical Candor. So, wow. and Gretchen is an old friend who has encouraged me to write this book along the way. So you've been talking to some of my favorite people. And the no asshole rule is one of the great books, of course, of all time.
No, absolutely. And I was talking to my wife, Anne, about your work, and in particular this idea that to provide meaningful guidance to someone, you really have to know that person, that your honesty will only be rewarded if it's coming from a place of true care. And I want to tell you a quick story because I thought it was just so relevant to everything you write about. So Anne told me the story. She runs Second City's Comedy Studies program with Columbia College, which is a fully immersive semester for college juniors and seniors where they learn the history and practice of comedy. So everything from silent movie to improvisation to stand-up, they both learn about it and have to do it. And at the end of each semester, or at the end of their semester, each student is brought into a room with all their teachers, so one student at a time, and each teacher gives the student a full assessment of where they think they are at. Intellectually, emotionally, practically, as it relates to them.
Wow.
Yeah, it relates to them as a student.
That's intense.
Yeah, and a would-be artist. So a few years back, there was a talented student who is really often late to class, and she missed assignments and was sick a lot. And Anne told her that she didn't feel that she would get what she wanted out of school or life if she didn't take care of herself first. And this was echoed by the other teachers. And a few days later, this student called Anne and said she had had a drug habit and was checking into rehab. And
wow.
This girl has been now sober for 2 years. She's in a relationship and she's doing great. And it strikes me that that is at the heart of what you talk about with Radical Candor.
That is such an amazing story. Yes, that is exactly at the very heart of it is sort of putting, and you don't necessarily have to know somebody personally, but putting your basic human connection, your basic human decency first.
Yeah.
One of the origin stories of Radical Candor for me is something that a perfect stranger said to me. I had this puppy and I adored the puppy. I was living in New York at the time and therefore never could bear to discipline it at all. And it was completely out of control. So mm-hmm. I'm walking down the street with this adorable golden retriever puppy and she hurls herself into the street, almost gets hit by a taxi. I pull her out of the way just in time. And a man, a perfect stranger on the street, looks at me and he says, the first thing he says is, I can tell you really love that dog, mm-hmm. right? That is all he had to do to show that he cared personally to establish that sort of basic human connection. And I said, yes. And then he said, but you're going to kill that dog if you don't teach it to listen.
Yeah.
And now he had my full attention. And, you know, if he hadn't started out by saying, I can see you really love the dog. When he said, you're going to kill that dog, you know, my response would have been, F you.
Right.
But it wasn't. He took a moment. And then he sort of looks at the ground, he points, and he says, sit. And the dog sat. I had no idea the dog even knew what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at him kind of in amazement, and he says, it's not mean, it's clear. And
right.
The light changes, and he walks off and leaves me with words to live by.
Yeah.
Right?
Wow.
One of the objections that people have to radical candor is that they don't have time. Mm-hmm. And not to take more than 30 seconds to establish a basic human connection.
Right. Because it's framing, right? And there's two things going on here. It's the framing of a conversation and coming from that place. And I think you offer really, really fresh and insightful framing the way that you talk about this stuff. So, like, you have the term give a damn access. Access, yeah, which I think is really nice because there actually is a tension between caring personally and challenging directly that you talk about, and that's so difficult to navigate. But when you sort of give it that label and allow it as a no, this is the way in which we're going to talk about this because I give a shit, that changes the dynamic completely.
Right, and I think there is a tension, but often there's also, I think, a false dichotomy between sort of caring and challenging, because it's not really caring not to challenge somebody when you see them making a mistake. In fact, it's profoundly uncaring.
Yeah.
So I think that part of the reason why I talk about care personally or the give a damn axis is, and often I talk about radical candor in terms of a basic 2x2 framework. So if you think about care personally or give a damn, that's the vertical axis. And then if you think about the horizontal axis is challenge directly, when you're able to do both at the same time, that's radical candor. And it's also really helpful, I think, to give names to what happens when you fail on one dimension or another, which we all do from time to time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you consistently show that you care but fail to challenge someone, I call that ruinous empathy.
Yeah. Right?
And I give it a strong sort of emotionally charged name in order to help people avoid that mistake. I mean, that is certainly been the story of a lot of my life is ruinous empathy.
Oh, tell me about it.
And I think that's where really 85% of mistakes at work and in human relationships in general get made. It's in that ruinous empathy quadrant. On the other hand, I think the quadrant that most people fear in a human relationship more than any other is the quadrant, you know, where you're challenging someone. This is why we don't challenge, but not showing that you care personally. And that's what I call obnoxious aggression.
Right.
Right? And then when you fail on both dimensions, I call it manipulative insincerity.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And so I want to actually jump ahead and talk about ruinous empathy, and we can come back to some of the other radical candor stuff. But, you know, improvisation is very big on empathy. We like it, and our practices support it. But I thought your example of ruinous empathy was so good, which is that infamous heck of a job, Brownie line that George Bush W delivered in the middle of the FEMA crisis. How is that an example of ruinous empathy?
Well, I mean, I think that I don't know because I've never talked to W, but I assume that what was going through his mind is he sees this guy who's worked with him and who's in a terrible situation, and he feels for him and he wants to sort of reassure him publicly that he's done a good job. And the problem, of course, is that when your primary focus is helping somebody else feel better as opposed to stating the facts of what has happened, if your assessment is badly off, if you tell somebody they've done a great job when in fact they've just screwed up terribly, very publicly, then the person is not going to believe you, so you're not going to make them feel better. And in fact, in the case of in the case of Brown, he said it was the worst thing that ever happened to him in his career. Not what happened during the crisis, but Bush saying heck of a job, Brownie. He said that'll be on my tombstone. You know, nobody will ever forget about that. That's how I'm known. And so often, you know, just in the spirit of trying to make someone feel better, we can actually make things much worse for them with sort of false praise.
Right. Well, you know, so Daniel Goleman talks about empathy being a form of social intelligence. And I think maybe one of the mistakes we make when we assume that is we're assuming, oh, it's social intelligence, so it's all intelligently intelligent empathy, but it can be very unintelligent empathy. In fact, this is something I've seen in myself completely in certain kinds of interactions where, you know, I care about someone seemingly, but I don't tell them that thing or find a way to give them the note that would allow them to improve. And then that's just sort of, you know, that's blind and ultimately not supportive and not friendly. And that's a reorientation, because we're not, you know, as human beings don't seem to be wired this way. And I think one of the things that you talk about is it's environments and behaviors. So as far as an environment, you talk about creating bullshit free zones. Totally right. Love that. How do you do it? What are the elements that make up a bullshit free zone?
Well, I mean, I think the first one is to create an environment where everybody understands that when you see something that you think may be wrong, it's an act of unkindness not to say it. And it's also an act of arrogance not to say it, because if you see something that you believe is a problem, you may be wrong about it. And if you sort of think, well, I'm certain I'm right, but I don't want to hurt the person's feelings, like, think about what you're saying. You're not opening yourself up to being challenged. It's not humble, because you're assuming that you're right. So you're not even giving the other person the opportunity to correct what may be just a misperception on your part. And if you are right, it's profoundly unkind not to tell somebody if they're screwing up, right? I mean, if somebody had spinach in their teeth, you wouldn't think, you know, you are so incompetent, you can't pick spinach out from between your teeth, so I'm not going to bother telling you, right? The same thing with a thousand other sort of larger issues that we see when we work together or collaborate in any other way.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you have a really good simple note, which is point out the good times in public and the bad times in private. So there's a bullshit free zone, you know, bullshit free zone being, you know, hey, if we're going to have this conversation about something difficult, you know, make it between you and I with a closed door.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think that it's really, especially when you're criticizing, you know, something that you see, not just somebody's work, because we do take our work very personally. We care about it. So if you're criticizing a mistake that someone is making consistently, very important to do it in private. I mean, there's obviously time for public debate, right?
Right.
But in general, yes, absolutely.
So I know you've told the story a bunch, but it's such a good one in terms of you had one of those private conversations with Sheryl Sandberg.
Yes. Yeah. So this was really sort of a revelation for me. It was shortly after I joined Google, and I had to give a presentation to Google's founders and CEO. And like any normal person, I was sort of nervous about the presentation. But luckily, the business that I was working on, AdSense Online Sales and Operations, and the business was doing great. When I said how many new customers we had added, Eric Schmidt, the CEO, almost fell out of his chair. So, you know, I felt reasonably confident by the end of the meeting that it had gone well. And as I was walking out the door, I walked past my boss, Cheryl, and was sort of expecting some sort of congratulatory high five. Mm-hmm. And instead, Cheryl said to me, "Why don't you walk back to my office?" And I thought, oh, boy, I've done something wrong. I have no idea what it is, but I'm sure I'm about to hear about it. Mm-hmm. And Cheryl started by telling me the things that really had gone well, and not in a kind of shit sandwich or feedback sandwich kind of way, but obviously sincere, and some stuff I actually hadn't known was good. In fact, there was some stuff I had done that I thought maybe had been a mistake, so she corrected that. So useful, mm-hmm. kind of truly useful praise. But of course, I didn't really want to hear any of that. What I really wanted to hear about was what had gone wrong. And eventually she said, "You said a lot in the meeting. Were you aware of it?" And when she said that, I sort of breathed a huge sigh of relief. If that was all I had done wrong, I wasn't worried about it. And I kind of made a brush-off gesture with my hand. And I said, "Yeah, I know. It's kind of a verbal tic. No big deal, really. I've given a lot of presentations in my career. I know what I'm doing." And Cheryl said to me, "You know, I know a really good speech coach, and Google would pay for it. Would you like an introduction?" And I sort of made the same brush-off gesture with my hand and said, "No, I'm busy." And Cheryl stopped. She looked me right in the eye, and she said, "When you say every third word, it makes you sound stupid," right? Mm. So now she had my attention, my full attention. I was going to go see the speech coach. And a lot of people would have said that it was mean of Cheryl to say it, "You sounded stupid." But it was the kindest thing she could possibly have done for me at that point in my career. Because if she hadn't, she knew me well enough to know that if she hadn't said it just that strongly, I was going to keep blowing her off, right?
Yeah.
She
yeah.
knew how to get through to me. She knew the words she had to use to get through to me. So that was sort of a revelation. I did, in fact, go to the speech coach, and she wasn't exaggerating. I said every third word, and I had given hundreds, if not thousands, of presentations in my life, and nobody had ever done me the courtesy of telling me that I had this problem. So, it was as though I had been walking around with my fly down my whole career, and nobody had ever said, "Hey, zip off your fly."
Yeah,
I could do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I just needed it pointed out.
Oh, that's so true. I mean, we talk, and I know you use the term guidance instead of feedback, which I appreciate, because we were talking to Josh Klayman, who's a scholar at the University of Chicago, and he has spent his career studying feedback, and his contention is most of the data shows that most feedback doesn't work. In fact, it often has the opposite effect.
And
you have a really great phrase where you say radical candor gets measured at the listener's ear, not the speaker's mouth. God, that's so smart, because you realize we think it's all, well, it's all up to us and how I say it. And it's like, no, it is just as much to how you hear it. So I think,
right.
You know, in that story with you and Cheryl, you played a role because at a certain point you did hear and you were able to hear. And so, and I think there's power inside understanding that, the preparation for being able to hear a note. We talk a lot about Second City where actors are not supposed to give each other notes, which I think in general is correct, but it's not the whole story, right? Because at other times, if someone's fly is down, you better be damn sure you got to give them that note, because they're out there on the high wire. I want to also talk to you about this idea of speaking truth to power, because mm-hmm. in satire, in comedy, in Second City's history, this is what it's about, right? We're always punching up.
Right.
But, you know, it's important in our work lives to be able to speak truth to power. And I don't think
vital.
I think, yeah. And I don't think most people know that they have that at their fingertips.
I think that's exactly right. And when I advise people, and the basics are true, this, whether you're offering radical candor up, down, or sideways, right? The place to start with radical candor is by asking people to be radically candid with you, right? By asking for criticism, not by offering it.
Mm-hmm.
And then by reacting really well when you get the criticism. So the rules of thumb that I offer for asking for criticism is, one, you've got to get yourself into the right frame of mind where you really want to hear it, and you've got to come up with a sort of a go-to question, because it's sort of awkward to ask.
Yeah.
And then when you ask, you need to, and this is counterintuitive, you need to embrace the discomfort, right? Because the person whom you're asking to give you some criticism, they don't want to give you any criticism, right? You've just put them in an awkward situation, And 99 times out of 100, what the person will say is, oh, everything's good, right? And they're visibly uncomfortable, and it's a natural human tendency. It's a ruinously empathetic tendency when someone is uncomfortable to try to make them comfortable. Mm-hmm. But you're never going to get radical candor if you try to make them comfortable. You actually have to embrace the discomfort, right? And say, I know there's something I'm doing that could be better. I really want you to tell me. And this was another thing, actually, I learned from Cheryl. She really wouldn't let you off the hook when she was asking for criticism. And it was brilliant because you really felt like you owed it to her to give it to her, to tell her what you really thought. And but it's true, you know, the same thing is true. Human relationships don't really obey the rules of hierarchy, right? We're all people regardless of our position. Mm-hmm. So it's the same is true whether you're asking for criticism from your boss or from your employee or from anybody, right? Mm-hmm. So once you finally have embraced the discomfort and gotten somebody to tell you something, then you need to reward the candor, right? You need to not just listen with the intent to understand, but you need to actually reward what they've done, because the person has taken a risk, right? So that's step number one, is solicit feedback, right? Mm-hmm. Then step number two is take some quick, like, I can see you really love your dog, like establish a human connection. And then once you've established that, then you start offering radical candor. But make sure you're using your good improv skills to understand how it's landing, right? Yeah. Pay a lot of attention to how it's landing for the other person.
There's a lovely improv phrase that the teacher and director Rick Thomas came up with, which is you have to learn to fall into the crack in the game. And what he means by
really
that, right?
Brilliant.
Yeah, it's really, you know, it's like it's that mistake that happens on stage that everyone sort of subtly acknowledges, maybe not don't even say anything, but go with it. And everyone loves it, right? The audience loves it, and then your partner on stage loves it, and that's the same in these interactions. And you know, this is the great thing about comedy, right? And people who can wield it so well are often very good communicators, because there's nothing better than to burst a tension bubble with a laugh. And allows everyone to sort of get to truth. Unfortunately, we're not all comedians or professional, and that can kind of backfire. So you have to be careful about it. But you know, one of the things that I think helps you to protect all of that is when you say we need to eliminate the phrase "don't take it personally."
Yes,
because we're gonna take it personally if you say "don't take it personally."
Right.
Yep.
And it's, you know, it's sort of like no offense. You know you're about to be offended.
You're about to be offended. We all know what's coming.
Right. So here's what I mean when I say eliminate the phrase "don't take it personally" from your vocabulary. I think very often when we're in a situation that we have to give guidance, especially if it's critical, if it's criticism, we want there to be no emotion in the interaction. We think we will be able to challenge directly more effectively if we can just remove emotion from the equation. And that may very well be true, but you're also not able to care personally if you remove emotion from the equation. And you know, you can't. We're all human beings. And most of us spend more time at work than in any other endeavor of our lives. So of course we take if we don't take our work personally, then, then we're eliminating half our lives.
Sure.
So that doesn't seem like the right solution. So anyway, the best advice I can give on moving up on the care personally axis is when you say something to somebody and you get an emotional reaction, don't reject it. Like, that's your opportunity not to back off of your challenge, but to move up on the care personally axis, to acknowledge the emotion and to react to it with compassion.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where you yes and, right? So you choose not to say no to it or block it. See all obstacles as gifts and run with it. Here's another thing that's really interesting about improvisation. And I think it's a behavioral thing in some of your theories. In improvisation, when a scene does not go well, there's usually like four or five or six different reasons, you know, why it is. And one of the biggest reasons, especially for beginning improvisers, is they are lacking specifics. That they have a tendency to go with vagaries. And you're like, no, it's never going to work unless you're fiercely specific about your words. And you talk a lot about how important specifics are.
Yeah, it is one of the difficult things about working with people, especially super intelligent people, but just with people in general. Like, what we are good at as human beings is abstraction. But when you get at that abstract level, the opportunities for miscommunication are endless, right? And so in a lot of ways, offering good guidance is very much like the rule of writing great fiction, which mm-hmm. is show, don't tell.
Yep.
Right? Don't say you're really smart. Say you can do the New York Times crossword puzzle in 3 minutes, you know. Mm-hmm. And then that allows you to show how you can build on that strength. Or sort of obvious on the negative side. Most of us wouldn't go to somebody and say the problem here is that you're just too stupid to do this job, right? Mm-hmm. But you know, the more specific you can be about your praise and your criticism, the more people know what to do next, right? And the more they understand what you're talking about. So the details are crucial
and
good guidance.
And you said this earlier, too, about your failures. Naming your failures takes the sting out. Releases power from those failures, allows you to then use those failures and play with them a bit. I mean, you went to the extent that you actually talk about, I think it was a different company, but you talk about they had like plush toys that they would give out to people who had a particular, like a failure monkey or something that they're best
around. Whoops the monkey.
Yes.
This was a technique that I learned from a guy called Dan Woods at a startup I did in New York, and then I used the same technique at Google, and it was surprisingly powerful. So the idea is, in order to make people more comfortable with criticism, it's useful to start with self-criticism. So what I did was I bought this stuffed monkey, and I stood up in front of the whole company, or the whole team, sort of 100 people, and I said, what we're going to do every week is we're going to tell a story. Anybody who has a story about a time that they screwed up, I want you to stand up, tell the story. You get instant forgiveness for whatever mistake you made, and the rest of the team learns to avoid that mistake, right? So it's good for you, and it's good for the whole team. It's a good opportunity to learn. It's about sort of making failure safe and making criticism fun. And of course, at first people were a little reluctant, so I had to do two things. I had to go in with some stories of my own, and I also, for the first couple of weeks, had to put $20 on Whoops's head. Now it wasn't really that everybody was, you know, so that Google salaries were so low that people were desperate for $20
for a 20 spot.
But it sort of gave them plausible deniability to play along. Okay, I'm just doing this because I want the $20.
Right.
And pretty soon it became one of the best parts of our weekly all-hands meeting at Google was Whoops the Monkey. And I learned so much about what was going on and how people were learning. And it really helped foster a culture where it was seen as safe and supportive to criticize one another. Of course, we also did praise. We also had this big stuffed killer whale, right? Mm-hmm. And you nominated other people for the killer whale,
right?
And so it's important when you're thinking about guidance to remember that both praise and criticism are equally important.
Last year, we took a visit to London for a bunch of different meetings, and one of our meetings was with Alain de Botton and the School of Life. Are you familiar with them?
I'm not, but it sounds fascinating.
Yeah, check out their website, schooloflife.com. So Botton is like he's a thinker, and he's on television a lot, and a thought leader in England. And he was doing a lecture where he talked about ancient societies, what the priest's role, especially when it was like sort of the family priest, because the family ran, you know, the town, that it was really their job to get the temperature of the commoners and be able to bring that to the king and to the court. And he said they were really kind of HR. At that time, but moral, ethical HR, sort of culture HR. And it strikes me with a lot of what you're talking about is the idea of getting out of sort of check the box thinking of this is how we have to behave and recognize that we are all humans in a community that needs support and empathy and tough love often and direction and all these things that you know, somehow got lost when the modern idea of what a business was supposed to look like somehow we took a cartoon version and sort of said, oh yeah, that's what business is going to be like, and let's just check our humanity at the door. When quite honestly, the opposite is what's needed right now.
Yeah, it really that phrase that you used really resonates for me. I mean, it is all about bringing your humanity to work. You can't do great work if you leave the best part of yourself at home.
Yeah,
and making sure that we are bringing our humanity to bear, and that we're not. I mean, I think part of the problem is when there is hierarchy. For some reason, we abandon everything we know about human relationships. Mm-hmm. And we don't have to, just because, I mean, because there is a situation, you know, when you're leading a company, there are people who are bosses of other people, but being a manager is a job. It's not some sort of validation nor does it signify in any way, shape or form that you're in any way, shape or form superior to somebody else. Right. So.
Right.
Sort of figuring out how to put hierarchy in its place and not let it interrupt basic humanity is, I think, what it's all about.
Yep. So we're coming to the end of our time, and one of the things we ask every guest who comes on the show is to think in their past, and you've kind of already given it, but I'm wondering if there might be another example of a yes and moment in your life. So the idea here is that when you're improvising, when you're making something out of nothing in a group, the way to kill that is by saying no, and you can't actually just stop at yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten, and this is kind of the basic orientation shift that we give all our students in improvisation, and that people really have to use as a practice, because we find that that's the way we make original things, and usually from discomfort, to your earlier point. So can you think back into your life, and it can be early too, you know, where you might have said no to something, but instead you said yes and?
Well, in a way, radical candor is a yes and moment for me. So what happened was this. I had started a software company in New York. This was in 2000. And on the same day, I had about 15 or 20 people send me this article. I think it was from the New York Times. I need to find it. And the article said that most people would rather have a boss who is an asshole than one who's really nice but incompetent.
Hmm.
And I thought, am I getting this because they think I'm incompetent or because I'm an asshole? And I'm not sure which is worse, really, frankly.
Yes.
And that was my moment where I wanted to say no to both of those options. And I wanted to say yes, and I can be both kind and competent. Let's try that.
Yeah.
And so that's the idea of radical candor. That was my sort of yes and moment.
That's fantastic. Folks, you can find out all about Kim's work at the website for Radical Candor. And there's also there's great blog posts and sort of tests and quizzes that you can look at. I really recommend you check it out. Kim, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. Lots of fun.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
This is Second City Works, getting to Yes And. You can find us at WGNplus.com. You can stream us on the WGN Plus app, or you can find us on iTunes. See you next week.